Everybody, it's Bud Belanich, and we have another issue of Experts on Call here, and boy, do we have an expert for you today. Dr. John Weinman is a professor in London, and he's agreed to share some of his thoughts with us on adherence. And John, from what I understand, first of all, welcome, but from what I understand, you've been doing a lot of work in the whole area of adherence. Could you just kind of tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and what your interests are?
Sure. I mean, my sort of overall interest is in how patients deal with illness, particularly with long-term illness. I'm really interested in all areas of their coping, you know, how they make sense of the illness, how they deal with it, how they manage it on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And about 25 years ago, I linked up originally with a pharmacist who came to me with this rather serious question about, you know, the patients he worked with just often not really following treatment, and it being source of, you know, frustration to him wanting to provide the best treatment for his patients. So he and I worked together very closely. He ended up doing a PhD with me. He's now one of the real leaders in the field. You know, he's just moved on. So really my interest stemmed from that time, seeing adherence not only to medication, but to all sorts of other advice that clinicians give, you know, lifestyle advice, and other advice and so on, has a real challenge for researchers like myself who are interested in the psychology of illness and treatment. So really, I've spent 25 years trying to understand all the different factors that can influence whether people do or don't adhere to treatment, and to really get an understanding of that. There are a whole range of factors as a basis for being able to work with patients, so knowing what drives their adherence or their non-adherence, I can then begin to work with those patients to perhaps help deal with some of the barriers or change some of the issues that are in their minds and so on.
Well, you know, you took your column, your recent PM360 column, takes all that 25 years of knowledge and sort of condenses it into one page. So congratulations on being able to do that. But you talk about how adherence is, from your perspective, is all about individual motivators and the barriers that individual human beings experience. And I think that's a very fascinating way to think of it. And I think it's slightly different from how we have been thinking about adherence. And so could you talk a little bit more about what you've written in that column and what you're finding?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, I think that the traditional way, you know, if you look way back, thinking about adherence, is that it was very much about people either not knowing what to do or not remembering what to do. You know, I think that's and a lot of people still think that's what the issue is. So, you know, there's been a lot of effort put into helping healthcare professionals, you know, describe the treatment more clearly, give people little reminders, you know, whether it be text messages or whatever. So as if that's the entire problem. And while that is part of the problem, it's only a pretty small part of the problem. I think what we've shown in our research is that there are probably three major groups of factors that can influence whether somebody does or doesn't adhere. What we call capability factors, in other words, things to do with people's knowledge, their understanding, their psychological capability, their ability to plan and organize their day, and also their physical capability, you know, whether they can literally use the inhaler, let's say, or open the bottle top or make the injection and so on. So there are capability factors which are important but probably not crucial. The crucial factors from our point of view are what we call the motivational factors, and the motivational factors are very much about what makes people really want to and feel they need to take their medicines. So it's very much around their beliefs about their condition, their beliefs about the illness, their beliefs about the treatment, including both positive and negative beliefs, beliefs that people have about their need to take the treatment, but also worries or concerns they might have about taking the treatment, worries about, you know, dependency and side effects and so on. And also in that motivational, sort of under that motivational heading, are factors such as the patient's mood. You know, if people very more commonly, More commonly, people who have major long-term health problems are more likely to suffer, say, depression, anxiety, and so on, because, you know, those problems, you know, carry a burden with them or various sorts. And if people, particularly if people are depressed, people are less likely to be motivated. We know that depression is associated with lower adherence, you know, consistently. And it's again around that sort of very demotivating aspect of depression, people feeling it's all too much, they can't control anything, it doesn't make any difference, and so on. So all those are motivational factors, belief factors, mood. So you like, you want to be something.
Yeah, it seems like it's a very nasty kind of like downward spiral. It's that you are end up with some kind of a chronic illness, which leads you to be depressed in general about your health and your well-being, which then, from what your research is showing, leads you to sometimes be less likely to adhere because of the depression. And that's a really a tough place to be, and I think something that we need to be addressing to be able to help people deal with their condition.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, depression is an important factor in adherence, but the important thing to note is it's not the only factor. Just as in the past we thought of it was all about forgetting or understanding, depression is one of the motivational factors that can really influence whether people are adherent or not. Because there are a lot of people who have a major condition, a major health problem, such as diabetes or asthma, and are not depressed, but they're still not taking medicine. And often because, let's say, their beliefs about their treatment or their illness just, you know, make it less likely. For example, you know, if someone with asthma who really doesn't believe they have asthma all the time because their symptoms come and go, so their belief about the condition is that it's a cyclical or phasic condition, and yet the clinician says to them, I would like you to take this preventer medication every day to keep the asthma at bay, or someone with, let's say, hypertension who has no symptoms at all ever, you know, they're asked to take daily medication in order to prevent a long-term, you know, much worse outcome. Those people may not believe, because they don't have symptoms every day or at all, they may not believe they really need to take the medicine. Or similarly, if they then start taking medicines and they develop side effects or feel things which they may actually feel they're worse off, so they develop negative beliefs and concerns. So those are really important factors. And we know the beliefs probably, well, from my point of view, I think the beliefs are probably the single biggest factor that gets in the way of medicine taking. But I should, before I sort of finish this bit, is say that I think I said there were three groups of factors: the capability factors that we've spoken about, the motivational factors that we've spoken about, but also what we call opportunity factors. And these are things outside the individual which can get in the way or stop them getting in the habit of good medicine taking. So it could be financial factors. So, you know, in some healthcare systems, probably particularly your own, financial factors may be a reason why someone is just not able to access their medicine because they don't have the funds. But also other factors outside the individual would include things like the support of their healthcare provider. If they have a very supportive and good healthcare provider, whether it's a doctor or nurse or whatever, that can really enhance good medicine taking or get in the way of good medicine taking. And there's support at home too. People who have good social support, people around them, people who are, for example, caregivers or partners or whatever, who really are interested in their health, they can really be encouraging and make sure that they, you know, that they follow. So we've really got a lot of factors. Say we've got these three major groups of factors, and under each are a number of other factors. So there's probably, you know, really 20, 30 major factors which can influence whether any individual takes their medicine or not. And when you ask me about it being a very personal thing, it's personal because for each individual, the particular factors that influence their medication taking could be any or all of those factors I described. Okay, so let's say if we, you know, we have 10 people with asthma who are not taking their medicine. For some, it may be very much capability factors, you know, problems in using their inhaler or problems in just planning. For others, it may be very much around, you know, their beliefs. You know, they really feel they believe, they don't believe they need to take it every day, or they may have worries about taking sort of steroidal type treatment and so on. And whereas others may just have very unsupportive healthcare professionals or people around them that sort of make it, you know, may change their motivation or make it less likely that they're taking. So for any individual, we need to know what the factors are. That's why it's a very personal issue. And even more complicated is that for any individual, those factors may change over time. So it's not it's a dynamic process. It's not a one-off. So we need to make sure we very carefully screen people to understand what is it for them that's getting in the way of good medicine taking, and to make sure we don't just assume that that's always going to be like that. We get back to them. We check to see if maybe their, you know, motivational factors now are increasing or decreasing, or whether or whatever it is, you know.
Well, you've set yourself quite a task here, and yep. You know, you've mentioned asthma a few times, and I know that you recently did a study where you were looking at the adherence with patients with asthma. What did you find there that can be of interest to pharma marketers and might go, you know, beyond the results of the asthma study to just adherence in general, as we're trying to produce drugs that are going to increase the people's lives.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a really nice example, that study. It was a study in which we took people who we knew were, they were sort of youngish adults, 18 to 45, and they were identified as people who were not adherent. And we put them into a trial, a randomized controlled trial. So they were randomized either to their usual care, and where we regularly measured their level of adherence every 6 weeks to see what their levels were like over time, over a period of 6 to 9 months. And then we had another group who we screened carefully at the beginning to identify the key beliefs for them about their asthma and about their asthma treatment. And on the basis of previous research, we knew which factors were associated with poor adherence. So we identified for each individual the key beliefs that were, we knew would be a problem for them in taking their treatment. Then what we did, because we wanted a pretty simple, scalable, pretty cheap solution, we developed a large bank of text messages that would be form a sort of challenge to each individual about their beliefs. So we messaged people with messages that would sort of, if you like, challenge the beliefs they had about their asthma or their treatment. So fairly simple text messages that were sent to them in a very personalized way. So if we identified, an individual came on the program and we saw that when we assessed them at the beginning, they didn't have a particularly strong need in the belief, a belief in the need for their treatment, or if they had maybe some concerns about taking their medication every day, or whatever, or didn't think that their asthma was something which was present all the time, whatever it is, we then had a whole bank of messages which we sent out to that individual over the first 6 weeks, quite a lot of messages, quite a few every week, very much targeted to the counteracting their beliefs. Then the following 6 weeks, the number of messages reduced down, so there was just sort of one or two a day. And then the final 6 weeks, it was an 18-week program, they just had a couple of messages a week. But the messages were always targeted to their own particular beliefs they had about their illness and treatment. So they were relevant to them. And we had a large bank of a couple of hundred text messages that we drew from, so we didn't have to repeat messages all the time. So people got different sorts of challenges, but they're always relevant to them.
So their adherence...
So what happened, we measured adherence every 6 weeks, you know, so three times up to the end of the 18-week program. What we found is that the people who were not on the program, their adherence level, which was around 45%, remained almost totally static over that time. So even though we're measuring their adherence, it's not changing because we're not doing anything to them. The other group their adherence levels went up by around 20%, up to about 65% of that group then became adherent and stayed the same over the 18 weeks. Now, the important thing is at that point, we stopped messaging. And with a reminder-based program, you would then see that once you stop sending people reminders, they go back to baseline. With our people, at 6 months and at 9 months afterwards, their adherence levels remain exactly the same. And what we've seen is we've changed their beliefs. What we do by challenging their beliefs in a very simple way. This is a very one-channel approach, one type of approach. And it was meant to be sort of cheap and scalable. And what we demonstrated that we could change people's beliefs and, much more important, we could improve their adherence as a result, as part of that motivational component of adherence.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so the communication channel you're using were text messages.
Yeah, only one channel.
Yeah. Have you looked into other channels that could possibly have similar kinds of results?
Yeah. I mean, I think the best programs, and it's been shown that the best programs to improve adherence or change any health-related behavior typically are multi-channel interventions. So if you can target people through a number of different sources, getting the strengths of those, so you can use, for example, emails, you can use interactive web-based systems, again, where people can reach in and they reach out, providing people, again, with challenges to, you know, or help in setting goals and maintaining goals and monitoring what they're doing. So using mobile phones, using apps, using, you know, obviously interactive computer systems with email and other web-based challenges, as well as much more conventional approaches, such as, for example, sending out magazines, which provide stories about patients a bit like them so they can read about how people dealt with challenges. And also another very powerful component of these interventions could be actual calls from, say, a nurse or a healthcare professional, either, you know, at regular intervals or allowing the patient to call that person. So these multi-channel approaches, I think, turn out to be probably the most powerful. But the limiting factor, obviously, is that some patients don't like some channels or maybe find it difficult to use some channels. And there's a cost factor as well, because, you know, with our asthma program, we went for cheap, we went for scalable. But, you know, and it's a relatively simple solution. These more elaborate multi-channel approaches, obviously more expensive for the healthcare provider, but ultimately are the more powerful ones, particularly ones where you give patients some choice as to the sort of channels they would like that suit them best in terms of both their, you know, their use of different technologies and their whole day-to-day, you know, sort of lifestyle.
It's absolutely fascinating to me because when I work with my management students and we talk about organizational changes, we talk a lot about multi-channel. So it's not all that surprising, but I think it's a new way to think about adherence. And you're right. I think that it can put somewhat of a burden on the healthcare provider. Mm. And so how can pharma marketers help healthcare providers with, say, a multi-channel approach?
Well, obviously, I think that big pharma companies have a really important role in providing additional services, because we know the adherence problem is so big. You know, if we're looking at 40-50% of patients not adhering, really the service they offer, as many pharma companies now acknowledge, needs to be beyond the product, beyond the pill. So it needs to be pill plus some sort of support service. So pharma companies, I think, can play a massive role in getting, there are a number of companies around now to develop programs and develop interventional strategies which are offered to patients at the same time when they're, let's say, offered a new treatment. So when they go to their pharmacist and start with a new treatment, patients can be offered a service, access to a support service, which should be free to patients, but could be very much provided by the pharma, big pharma, or indeed the healthcare provider as part of their service to really maximize good medicine taking.
So you've been working with the folks at Atlantis Healthcare to who work with pharma companies to figure out how to do this kind of stuff, which, like most things, seems to be simple in concept, but probably difficult to implement.
Yeah, well, actually not that difficult to implement. You know, the big problem really, you know, I think we've now got, say, for example, you take Atlantis as an example. They've got very, very good programs which have been designed and developed by their health psychology team, which use multi-channel approaches, really use our understanding of all those factors I talked about earlier to that are influencing adherence, as well as an understanding of the different behavior change techniques you need to change those factors, whether they're beliefs or whether they're just day-to-day, patterns of regular, planning and medicine taking. I mean, there are a whole lot of, those factors. They all need to be changed in different ways. They need different behavior change techniques. So that the science, if you like, the health psychology science of all of that is getting pretty well established. So that's not the difficulty. The difficulty, and also turning those insights into really good, compelling programs, support programs for patients. Again, we've become very good at that. I think what the block now is for healthcare systems to embrace these, really innovative approaches, to be willing to pay for them as well. And also to make sure that it's easy for patients to enroll or engage with these programs, because I think there's quite a lot of programs out there and some people have found that, the uptake of them has not been that good. It's almost like another adherence problem. So getting patients to engage with the programs, I think once patients are on these programs, they get huge benefit. We've seen the huge benefit. So making them almost a routine part of healthcare now, I think, is the challenge. Because the programs themselves are great and they're well developed.
All right. Well, John, any last words of wisdom for pharma marketers here? And would you go over, and I think some of the best last words might be to just review your three major buckets before we sign off here.
Well, I think the key things for me, and I think the key insights for pharma are, firstly, that the old ways of trying to segment patients haven't worked. That really the whole patient segmentation process is very much got to be based around our understanding of the drivers of their behavior. Okay, and as I've said, we know a lot about those drivers. So really good screening of patients to understand the issues for them. Secondly, finding the best and the most effective behavior change techniques and channels for dealing with those issues that patients have. And thirdly, I think somehow being able to seamlessly put those programs in the patient pathway, in the clinical pathway for patients, to make them an everyday part of that clinical pathway in a way that clinicians should not feel threatened by. This is something which should very much support the clinician as well as the patient. We're not trying to take anything away from the clinician. This has been, these are ways in which we could really help improve, effective healthcare and create effective healthcare for patients.
Well, John, thank you. I know that you're running up against a deadline here.
Yeah.
We try to keep these interviews short, so pharma marketers are busy. So I really appreciate it. And, folks, I've been speaking with Professor John Weinman on topic of adherence. You need to read his article in PM360 and check out what the folks at Atlantis Healthcare have to offer, because they're on the cutting edge of how we are dealing with patients with adherence issues. So John, again, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and tremendous information and a fascinating study that you did with the asthma patients, and just showing how a small intervention like text messages can really improve adherence. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Bud. It's been a pleasure talking to you.